This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
This is the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I'm Helen and it's great to have you with us. All about health on today's episode and some incredible doctors and experts joining us. We were discussing depression in light of a study that has really shaken the medical community. We brought in Dr. Hassan, consultant in family medicine at King's, to explain exactly what this study is showing. And for those who are on antidepressants, does that mean chucking them in the bin? Make sure you share this with anyone who might have some concerns. Discussing free dental checkups and treatment, Dr. Reshma is on hand explaining some of the challenges people of determination have when it comes to keeping their teeth healthy, and the joys of preventative medicine. Don't just wait until you're sick to go to the doctor. Dr. Maria Alonso from Maison Santé was on hand to explain some of the things we can do every single day to stay healthy for as long as possible. And in the psychology hour, it was clinical psychologist Dr. Thry who was on hand explaining sibling rivalry in grown-ups.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Throughout the course of the show, we are going to be introducing you to some great experts, brilliant doctors, all on hand to take your questions. So please, if there's something that's on your mind, you want to share your opinion, or indeed you've got a question that you need an answer to, please don't hesitate to get in touch. In this first hour, after decades of research, scientists have found that there is no evidence that depression is caused by, quote, a chemical imbalance or low serotonin levels. And this has sparked fierce debate in the medical community and across news sites as well, of course. And those people taking antidepressants are going to doctors and asking some big questions. So this is according to research led by the University College of London. And prescriptions for antidepressants have risen dramatically since the 1990s. One in six adults in England, and now 2% of teenagers, are being prescribed an antidepressant in a given year. So if this new theory is correct, are they necessary anymore? Should those of us who are on antidepressants just be putting them in the bin? We'll be finding out. So let's hear from you and let's hear from our expert of the hour. Dr. Hassan is a consultant in family medicine at King's College Hospital here in Dubai. Dr. Hassan, how are you?
Hi, Helen. Thank you so much for having me with you this afternoon.
You're very welcome. I mean, I've got questions about this, the study. I've got questions, I guess, as a patient as well, because you know, I've made no secret of the fact that I had postnatal depression and was given medication. And this is something that, you know, we talk about a lot on the show about how depression is diagnosed, how treatment is decided. So we're going to be exploring that. But I'd love it if you wouldn't mind kind of explaining a little bit about this research in terms that us non-doctors, Dr. Hassan, could understand. Are you able to give us a bit of an interpretation?
Absolutely, that's absolutely fine. So yeah, I mean, I myself as a doctor have taken interest in this research mainly because of the you know, anticipated conversations that I was expecting to be having with patients coming in with concerns as a result of this. This review came out around about July this year, and it, as you said quite rightly, has sparked fierce debate. So I think first of all, it's probably helpful to start talking about serotonin before we talk about this report, so that people understand what it is and why it's important. So essentially, serotonin is a neurotransmitter, so it's a chemical in our brain. And as you said, for decades, we have thought that actually having low levels potentially could cause or result in us having a low mood, which could be a preset to developing clinical depression. Now, the thing is that for years we have been using medications, and the medications that we give for depression, typically SSRIs, which stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. What they do is they increase the amount of serotonin available in the brain. What this research was actually a review of prior research. So first point to make is this is not new research, and there's been no new trials that have been done. This is really a look back, if you like, at what's been done in the past. And I have to say, it's not exhaustive. They haven't looked at everything. And it also doesn't offer us any explanation or an alternative explanation for what actually causes depression at a molecular level. And I don't think that that's actually entirely clear to anyone. And actually, what we know already is that in the vast majority of cases, to say it's just due to serotonin is a little bit of an oversimplification.
A bit reductive.
Because we are talking at the end of the day about a very complex network in the brain that processes emotions and stress. And we know that negative life events and stress plays a much more significant role in the development of depression. It's very important that people suffering with severe depression are not discouraged after hearing this analysis. And what I would like to say first and foremost is please do not just suddenly stop your antidepressants if you've read this, because of there are potential concerns like withdrawal symptoms that can happen. So I would urge people to discuss this with their doctor first.
Thanks, Dr. Hassan. That's hugely helpful as a starting point. We've already had questions along these lines and wanting to understand a little bit more. I mean, I think I'd also say that, you know, depression as a phrase, as a diagnosis, is so varied as well in terms of individual symptoms, behaviours, how things are diagnosed, severity, of course. But what I find really interesting is, you know, as I said earlier, you know, the number of people that are being diagnosed and medicated right now is you know, undeniably on the up. But we still know relatively little about depression and the treatment of depression in the brain because, well, presumably we've got very limited access to that living human brain tissue. So you can't actually perhaps have those quantitative measurable results that you know might see in other medications and trials.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking mental health this hour, clinical depression in particular, of course, a serious mental illness that affects quality of life and well-being. And the World Health Organization has noted that around 280 million people worldwide live with it, which is why, having looked at a study that came out just a few weeks ago, scientific communities have been rocked. Individuals are questioning their treatment because serotonin, the neurotransmitter that affects people's moods and behaviors, is what's often addressed when it comes to treating depression with medication called SSRIs that can be often very effective, according to anecdotal and scientific studies, in treating symptoms of depression. This goes back to the 1960s, but a review has examined data that are now saying that there's weak evidence that low levels might affect people with depression. So we're bringing in the experts, Dr. Hassan, with us this afternoon from King's College Hospital, London, here in Dubai. And I'd love to perhaps take a little kind of peek behind the scenes, Dr. Hassan, if you wouldn't mind, about when it comes to you in a clinical setting, a patient coming to you with symptoms of depression or what you might believe to be symptoms, how do you then come to the point of diagnosis and get an understanding of the best treatment method for them, whether that is, you know, CBT or talk therapy or medication? What are some of the questions or even the checklist that you might be referring to in clinic to get to that conclusion?
Certainly. So the my current practice and the practice that we adopt here is in accordance with the UK guidelines. So we follow the NICE, or National Institute for Clinical Excellence guidelines, which is all evidence-based. So it's firstly important, for starting from the doorstep, really, is to know that actually 45 to 95% of patients that come with depression actually only come with physical symptoms and don't necessarily volunteer the fact that they are feeling low. So sometimes patients do come in and I'll direct and say, look, doctor, I'm feeling so low, you know, my get up and go has got up and gone, basically, and I'm not able to sleep. Others can be a bit more vague, saying, I'm just feeling tired all the time, or actually say, you know, doctor, I've got an ache all over, I've got no appetite, my headaches. And it takes a little bit of skill from the doctor to actually, you know, spend time listening to the patient and actually to understand, really, are there any sort of obviously, once we've excluded any physical cause, medical other causes, is to actually see, you know, how they're feeling. Now, as a doctor, what I would do is do a screening question for the patient. So I'd be asking, so over the past month, how often they've been bothered by feeling down, depressed or hopeless? And then secondly, you know, how often have they had little interest or pleasure in doing things? And if the answer is yes to any of those, then we have to go in and assess them. The way we assess patients is by using something called the 9-patient health questionnaire, which is a set of questions, again, on the same theme, those two questions I just asked, but expanding that a little bit more, thinking about, you know, suicidal ideation, you know, self-care and things like that, and then splits the patient into having less severe or more severe depression. NICE recently sort of reviewed the management of depression, and now it has become much more condensed in that sense that the patient now either is graded as having less severe or mild depression or severe depression, depending on the scoring coming out of this health questionnaire. Now, it's very important to say on the background of the review that has just been published that NICE has stipulated very clearly that it's important that we don't rush into making a diagnosis, or even it's important for us as doctors not to rush into making a prescription on the first visit. It's really important for doctors to take time to listen to the patients. And then the decision to start medications is a shared decision between a doctor and the patient. So that depends a lot on the weight patients place on certain values and preferences. And sometimes it takes time. You know, patients may need to go away and discuss options with their family or those close to them after having been informed about the options. But actually what we hear from NICE is actually the evidence for antidepressants now is more in favor for patients with severe rather than mild depression. And what could be, you'll be interested to hear is actually the first-line treatment for patients with mild depression is not necessarily medication, but actually in the form of psychological therapy. And that we mean cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT, mindfulness. There is a number of psychological therapies available that are useful depending on, you know, what sort of person you are, what sort of issues there are that have been happening in the background are tailored towards the patient. So in a nutshell, that's kind of how we arrive at the diagnosis, and to say that, you know, we aren't really rushing to put, there is no sort of rush to put people on medications, and we can take time. Sometimes just active monitoring is all that's required. For instance, if it's adjustment disorder, you know, adjustment disorders are like a temporary depression. Something's happened that's likely to change in the short future. For patients like that, you know, just a question of time and regular review, regular contact with the doctor to check and things aren't deteriorating may just be enough, and that's what's needed.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you in terms of, I guess, depression or mental state that can be triggered by an event. I mean, for me, as I said, it was postnatal depression, and I went to a colleague of yours at King's, really desperate, I think, for permission to go on medication. And that's something I'm coming off now, and it's you know, as you say, with monitoring and other methods, it's been great. I mean, I really say that in a very positive way. It's been fantastic, and I've been really lucky to be so supported and kind of educated, I guess. But that was me knowing myself very well and being confident to go to a medical professional and say, I am not okay at all. And, you know, what are my options? And we've had a message here for us saying a doctor tried to prescribe an antidepressant after my dad was diagnosed with cancer. Yes, I was depressed, but for good reason. It was absolutely awful. So depression doesn't mean there's something wrong with him, he says. It's part of life. So as you say, when there are these kind of stresses and triggers and these awful downs that so many people experience because of an event, what do you tend to recommend in that sense? You know, what do we know about the effectiveness of medication on a short-term basis, or are there things that you would prefer to discuss with a patient in those circumstances?
Absolutely. So, I mean, that's really, really important, because that is one aspect that is really key in understanding what is going on, what has been going on in the background in the patient's, you know, life at home. Now, when we assess patients, we talk about the five lives, and these are important to explore, even with a patient like this who's just had a single episode. But it could be, you know, a momentary depression on the background of depression, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, the patient may have been feeling low before this began, and for other reasons. So we would explore their life at home, looking at their relationship issues, home circumstances, finances, employment issues. Life events, like you described, so stresses or recent family loss or you know, traumatic events. Lifestyle, so their sleep, diet and exercise, any sort of drug or alcohol misuse. And life before, so looking at, you know, is there any history of depression in the past, any physical illnesses? We mustn't forget that a lot of patients with physical diseases, so chronic diseases like diabetes, hypertension, you know, cancer, can develop depression as a result or as a continuum with those physical conditions as well. And finally, life lost, you know, is there any risk of suicide, self-harm? So once we've done a risk assessment and looked at the patient as a whole, this is all about holistic care that's really important. We can then arrive at a sound judgment with the patient. You know, it's a team game here between doctor and the patient, really. To understand, you know, how bad are things and what are the options. In a sense, we want to give the patient a menu of options at the end of it.
And from a patient point of view, you want to have a doctor that you really trust, you know, because you're going to be you're putting yourself in a vulnerable situation by asking for help, and you are privy to far more information and at a much more technical scientific level than we as members of the public are ever going to be, which is why you need a doctor to interpret this, to be thinking about, as you say, the best practice? What is best suited?
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're looking behind the headlines and looking at a recent study today. This is all to do with antidepressants. And the prescriptions for antidepressants have risen dramatically over the last couple of decades. And I'd have a good guess over the last couple of years as well. And a new theory, not necessarily a new study, the data isn't new, but they're taking a new look. Scientists have found there is no evidence that depression is caused by, quote, chemical imbalance or low serotonin levels. This has really created somewhat shockwaves throughout the medical community. And of course, those people who are taking antidepressants going to their doctors and asking, well, why and what now? Do get in touch if you've got any questions around this. We're in conversation with Dr. Hassan Alagoli, a consultant in family medicine at King's College Hospital here in Dubai. Dr. Hassan, as I predicted, many people getting in touch with questions around this, but also relating to mental health in general. You mentioned earlier some medical conditions that might lead to signs of depression, things that you'd be investigating, questions you'd be asking in clinic. And one here saying, is IBS connected to anxiety? And I guess by extension, other mental health issues. For you as a doctor, how do you unpick that kind of what comes first, the chicken or the egg? You know, is IBS a symptom of depression, or do you perhaps get anxiety because of your having this difficulty around gut health? How do you start to unpick that and perhaps answer that question?
Thank you. That's a really good question. Actually, it is both the chicken and the egg in this situation, because actually in some patients, the symptoms of IBS can pre-exist anxiety, and in others, anxiety can come on before the IBS. The two appear to be interlinked. And actually, and interestingly, ironically, the reason is because of serotonin. The actual serotonin in the body, most of it is in the gut. Compared to the brain, which in some ways leads to us to understand why we have some of the side effects we see with antidepressants. However, we do know that medications like SSRIs are used, usually as second line, but not as first line for things like IBS. So it is perfectly possible for both anxiety and IBS to coexist. And in fact, one can potentiate the other. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important for us to take as I said before, again, a holistic approach with this, to look at the gut, how we can manage those symptoms, but also, you know, is there any thing we need to do about the anxiety as well?
Okay, let's go to, we've got a couple of messages that are quite similar, but also some are really a message that's been coming through about people really not knowing what to do next. So anonymous message here saying, I've had some kind of social anxiety with no desire for going out or enjoying the activities that I used to enjoy before. How can I fight this and cope with that and make it a normal thing? And another message here saying, I keep on going over and over whether I feel bad enough to warrant going to my doctor for medication. I can get up for work. Other days I don't want to. I don't want to go to places. I don't want to see anybody. Had to go visit family recently and was dreading the entire weekend. I dream about living somewhere remote. I know I'm isolated. I know I need to mix with people, but I can't motivate myself to do that. I'm more existing than living, and maybe that's okay. I know I want to change things, but I can't. And will medication really change anything? So messages there that are really kind of echoing each other and perhaps echoing thoughts of people listening today who haven't picked up the phone. And I wondered what advice perhaps you would give. And you're speaking to us today as a consultant in family medicine and not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I know you work in tandem with people in the team there at King's. What would you say to anyone in this situation, Dr. Hassan?
First of all, do not despair, because there are many, many different options available. And people may have heard only about one or two options, which are drugs or CBT, for instance. But actually, when it comes to drugs, first of all, there is a variety of medications. So when one hasn't sort of responded to one, there are two options, that either increasing the dose or switching to a different class. But what's really more important is to talk about, because I feel personally that psychological therapies is slightly more important than the medications, because in contrast to the article that's brought this into light, this discussion this afternoon, actually our view of medications is that they are a tool rather than treating the cause. Because remember, medications don't teach you how to cope with difficult situations or may help you to understand what's going on. They are just simply a tool to lift one's mood. What's more important really is a psychological therapy. So my answer is that if one thing hasn't worked, there are other options. Now, it may be that patients are receiving a form of psychological therapy that doesn't really marry up to the kind of condition they're in. For example, if you are somebody with depression and if the depression has led to social withdrawal or inactivity, then something like behavioral activation may be more beneficial than CBT. So behavioral activation doesn't directly target thoughts and feelings, for instance. They focus on identifying the link between an individual's activity and their mood. So things like, you know, recognizing patterns and making practical changes to reduce avoidance and, you know, increasing behaviors which help to improve your mood. So I think that my answer is really that we need to group together again with the patient and to understand what's worked in the past, what hasn't worked, where are they now in their mood, review all of that, and then look at what alternative psychological therapies are available that could potentially help in these situations.
And I think it shows a great self-awareness for these listeners or indeed anyone else that's having similar thoughts that, you know, you are listening to yourself, you are tuning into yourself. And it's often a case, as we said earlier, about finding an expert, someone you trust who can help you talk through your options. And for many people, they don't even get to this point of thinking, actually, something's not quite right here and I want to make a change. And a great message here from Fran, Dr. Hassan, saying, my goal on antidepressants is to reach a point where eventually I don't need them. They are a tool for breaking a destructive cycle so I can change my mental habits. They've helped me become more functional again, but I don't want to stay on them long term. And Fran, that's exactly how I feel. And as I said earlier, I'm in a process now after 5 years of being on medication following postnatal depression to be coming off them. And I'm doing that, of course, under doctor supervision with, as I said, one of your colleagues at King's, Dr. Hassan. But I wondered, for anyone who might have read this study or seen, you know, lazy journalism around this study and thought, okay, right, well, antidepressants don't work, I'm going to flush mine down the toilet, they're going to go in the bin. You know, how and when do you recommend people come off medication properly, efficiently, safely?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, that's a really important question. So I think the decision to stop antidepressants is an important decision because one needs to recognize, and as you said, sort of think about where they are in life at that moment in time. You know, has the stressors or the lifestyle impacts or things that have occurred, have they moved into a better place in their life once that medication stops? The first point to make is that we can't just stop antidepressants suddenly. So they've got to be tapered down. And the reason we need to taper them down is because of the risk of getting a withdrawal syndrome or withdrawal symptoms if we suddenly stop them. Now, in accordance with NICE guidelines, what we would normally do as doctors, if someone approaches us to stop the antidepressants, is that due to the risk of relapse being significant in some situations, we usually continue for the antidepressants for 6 months after remission. And we continue that because of the fact we know that if we stop them earlier in some situations, then the risk of relapse is higher. The problem is if someone relapses after stopping medications, you may end up going on a higher dose than you were before, with the chances of there being more side effects. So it's really a decision that needs to be made carefully between the doctor and the patient. So we need to consider the potential risks for continuing antidepressants as well, because it's a risk-benefit balance that we need to achieve. And to be honest, I don't think that we've got very good data that demonstrates the safety of really long-term antidepressant therapy. So I think it is justified for patients to think, you know, I don't really want to be on this too long. But at the same time, there is a time and a place, I think, to do this, and it's got to be done safely. What's really important is that doctors have regular reviews and regular follow-up. And actually, what's been proven in studies is that actually having psychological therapy at the end, so when you are planning to come off the medications, actually having psychological therapy right at the end and during the tapering off period actually reduces the risks of relapse.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joined now by a consultant in family medicine at King's College Hospital, Dubai, Dr. Hassan Al-Ghaili. We're discussing research led by the University College of London looking into, there is, quote, no evidence that depression is caused by chemical imbalance or low serotonin levels. This has sparked fierce debate in the medical community and, of course, created lots of questions amongst those people who are taking antidepressants. And we're taking your questions here on 4001 on the ARN Play app and, yes, on the WhatsApp too. So please do get in touch. There's anything that's on your mind. Dr. Hassan, a message here from Omar saying, just want to know if there's any support groups organised here in the UAE, or is there a possibility to organise something like that? I personally don't know. I don't know if you know of anything similar to this, but perhaps in general terms, when we're thinking about talk therapy, you know, support groups, whether it's on Facebook or in real life? What do we know about, you know, effectiveness or usefulness, suitability when it comes to treating low mood and depression?
Absolutely. There is a strong evidence base, I think, for what we call psychological therapies. And psychological therapies takes many forms, actually, when we look at this, including group therapies, including CBT one-on-one, as well as other things like group mindfulness meditation, group exercise, guided self-help, counseling, interpersonal psychotherapy. I mean, the list goes on and on in terms of what is actually available. In terms of Dubai, I mean, I can only speak for King's College Hospital in terms of what we provide. We do have psychologists here, and we do provide cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT, which has, I think, you know, very strong and sound evidence base for an effectiveness for managing depression, not just in the short term, but also long term, because essentially you're talking about thoughts, beliefs, attitudes, feelings, and how behavior interacts with each other, and actually teaching people coping skills in the long term. So in terms of what else is available in Dubai, I think there are other sort of counseling, and there's Lighthouse Arabia, the Carbone Clinic, and Thrive. They are all sort of available in Dubai as well, that also provides sort of talking therapies and counselling.
Thanks, Doctor. We've had a couple of messages that I'm going to kind of paraphrase as we finish, which is really how to get help for a family member who you believe is suffering from depression, how to broach that. And I wondered if you could offer any insights or wisdom there, because, as I said earlier, some people have been in touch today with a huge amount of self-awareness around their own mental health and wanting to get help or just share what they've been through. But we've also had a number of messages worried about members of their family. And I wondered what you tend to advise in these situations.
So the first thing is sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. And the worry is where you can't. And obviously you need to get help straight away to intervene, because of the possibility that in the most severe cases, people can become what we call in the medical world anhedonic, or completely lacking any physical activities, such as they're not self-caring, not eating, etc., etc. I think the first point to make with a family member like this is to really give them time to sit down and to really try to get them to understand what they're feeling and why they're feeling the way they are feeling, and actually the fact that they are loved and cherished, and actually you want them to sort of help for them. Now, culturally, some people may be against going to the doctor or owning up, and we mustn't forget men here, because men's mental health is also something that doesn't get talked about very much. We know that, for instance, men are less likely to seek help for feeling low. Sometimes they sort of prefer to bottle their emotions up more than anything else. It goes against the masculine sort of macho sort of character that men like myself have generally, but not all men are like that. But it's important to kind of sort of to get underneath that if one is able to. I think if I may, it's helpful for people to get their family to understand really what how things are ending up where they are, because depression starts with negative thinking styles, excessive self-blame, you know, sort of doubt, sort of discounting their positive experiences. These are thoughts, things like, you know, I'm useless, I'm boring, I'm a burden to my family. These can then lead into problematic behaviors like stopping any enjoyable activities, so not resting excessively, you know, not looking after themselves, withdrawing socially, and that itself can lead to physical symptoms then. You know, well, if you stop exercising, start to feel tired, your concentration gets affected, your sleep, and that can affect the way you feel. So you start to feel sad, anxious, and that can then reinforce your thoughts, if you see what I mean. So this is a cycle of thoughts into behaviors, then to physical symptoms, influencing our feelings, and then reinforcing the fact that, you know, we are feeling low and that there's no point in going on.
Dr. Hassan, I really can't thank you enough for your time this afternoon. I think it's so refreshing to hear from an enlightened doctor. We know we hear about the medical side a lot, but to understand, you know, how things work from a doctor's point of view when it comes to diagnosing, treating, working with patients, it's really refreshing, truthfully. And I'm glad that this study has sparked debate, started questions, and really allowed people to examine what they've been going through and perhaps what treatment might look for them, whether it is going down that talk route, looking at how medication could help, but ultimately having conversations with people that are as well informed as you. So thank you so much. I'm going to let you get back to your busy clinic today.
Thank you very much for the time.
But we'll speak to you very, very soon indeed. And if you do want Dr. Hassan's details, I'll be very happy to share them. Dr. Hassan, wishing you a wonderful afternoon ahead. Dr. Hassan is a consultant in family medicine. If you would like his details, please do get in touch. As I said, he can be found there in the family medicine department at King's College Hospital, Dubai.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking teeth now. Now, taking kids to the dentist, I can say from my own experience, can be a challenge in itself. What about children of determination, taking them in for dental checkups? If this is something that's been problematic for you in the past, get in touch and listen carefully, because one dentist here in the UAE is not only helping children, but adults of determination when it comes to taking care of their oral health, and she's offering them some free checkups too. Welcome, Dr. Reshma Paveen from Signature Dental Clinic in Ras Al Khaimah to the studio. Lovely to have you with us, Dr. Reshma. Now, you said earlier, people hate dentists. I don't hate dentists, but I understand where a lot of people's fear comes from. Lovely to have you with us. I'd love to know a little bit more about why you've taken this decision to offer free checkups for people of determination in particular. Why do you feel like this is such an important part of a medical offering?
Thank you, first of all, for giving me this opportunity to come down here, and you know, I can reach out to more people out. And I've been practicing for the past 18 years in UAE. The 17 years was in Al Ain. I was working in Al Ain, and now I opened my own clinic in Ras Al Khaimah, the Signature Dental Clinic. So this has been always my dream, to give back something back to the society in which we live, you know. So because in this era when people are just thinking of stuffing their wallets with, you know, how to increase your thing, no one thinks about, but it was my dream always to be a part and just give a little to the society.
Yeah, be part of that community.
Yeah, exactly. Be a part of the community. So I was always thinking, like, how can I do this as a dentist? And it's my own setup, so there's no upper hand on me, and it's all my decision. So that's when I came up with the Rock Live person. He's Mr. Isa. So he used to come to me for treatment, and he gave me this idea, like, would you really like to do this? Like, can we go, do you want to give free treatments? So I said, yeah, why not? Because, you know, treating these people give a lot of peace, first thing. They are very beautiful people with a very beautiful heart. And I've been treating PODs, people of determination, for the past now 1.5 years, because last March we opened our clinic, and I treat them free of cost. All the treatments, regardless of whatever they need, their needs. You see, there's nothing much sometimes we can do, but still a little care makes a lot of difference in them.
It makes a huge difference in terms of individual health, but also, as you say, that peace of mind for a family. And yeah. Dr. Reshma, it's going to vary hugely depending on age and diagnosis, but what are some of the main challenges that people of determination might have about taking care of their teeth at home, and then equally what you might need to do in the dental clinic?
See, first of all, it's very important to understand here that intellectual disability, what these people have, it's not a disease. Or no, it's a mental illness, fine. This is just a development disorder the people have. And you just need to take care of that. All they need is love, care, affection, and a little bit of a communication, make them comfortable. And then they're ready to go. You know, because I'm getting patients coming from Dubai, you won't believe, who could not afford dental treatments. Because the moment you go as a special child or a special patient with some disabilities, they charge you 3 to 4 times more, because it takes more time and patience to treat these patients. Mm-hmm. But when they come to me, they come all the way, because they cannot afford this treatment back here. So when they come to know through people that I give free treatment, they have come down all the way from here to Ras Al Khaimah. So it just takes a matter of time to just be friendly with them. You have to just, you know, develop a rapport with these patients, and they are all ready to go. They are very nice. I think sometimes better than even my normal patients.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
But we're talking teeth now. Welcoming to the studio Dr. Reshma Paveen from Signature Dental Clinic in Ras Al Khaimah. She's on a mission helping out people of determination with free checkups and treatment. And we've had a number of messages and a number of questions. And this is coming through from Ambreen. Have a listen to this.
So I have twins on the autism spectrum, and they have a lot of oromotor sensitivity, and they have a lot of sensory issues. So taking them to a dental clinic is always a nightmare. So lately I started observing that they have black hollow cavities, and I took them to a few dental clinics, and it was a chaos. It's always a nightmare to take them to a dental clinic. they push a little during the checkup, it will end up in a lot of behaviors always. By the end, they always suggest us to get the treatment under the general anesthesia. So I just wanted to ask you that, is it worth taking the risk? Is it okay to get them treated while they're under the general anesthesia?
So Ambreen there, who's got twins with autism and they have cavities, find it very challenging to go to the dentist, and there's been advice around having a general anaesthetic. So sedation in order to have treatment. Is this something that you've come up against in the past? Is it something you'd recommend for certain patients, Doctor?
Yeah. See, Ambreen, right? If I'm right, yeah. It's very difficult to sometimes treat the kids inside the general office, because the main issue we face is anxiety with the among the kids, and especially when it is the mental challenges they face through. So it takes time, but we have done a couple of cases. We have tried being friendly. We have to give them a lot of time, you know. They have to get friendly to the dentist.
And with anyone with fear, you know, we often make the association of being in the dentist chair with treatment, with, you know, having some, you know, somebody with their hands in your mouth, with somebody close to your face, and, you know,
it's very scary.
For anyone who's kind of neurotypical, this can be really upsetting. But for anyone who perhaps is younger, is on the autism spectrum, is, you know, is unfamiliar in this situation, this must be really quite traumatic. So building that trust over time.
Yeah, that's very important. So usually in my first sittings, I try to just get friendly with these kids, and then we do minimum, you know, we just introduce them to the dental clinic, and then we start. But in some cases, when it is not possible, then yes, general anesthesia or something that is called conscious sedation, you know, the nitrous oxide gas.
Laughing gas.
That really helps. But there are some challenges when you use these things. Like, you should be very, of course, you'll be getting it done in a hospital, not in a normal clinic-based setup. So what you have to do is, like, you have to be very specific about the drugs and the medications the kid is having, so that they don't cross-react with the medications what the doctors use. So if you give them the right prescriptions, what you have, I think they will do a lovely job by doing this. But you can try without, you know, because the expense that comes off with the general anesthesia and conscious is very high. So if it is affordable and the patient can really go ahead, they are very welcome to do that. But there are patients who cannot, then yes, it's a couple of sittings which is needed for them. And maybe, you know, we can really try to do one or two of them.
A question here from Danny saying, tips for overcoming fear of the dentist for my 8-year-old. Hasn't mentioned any issues or diagnosis, but I guess for a lot of children, it can be a bit of a scary experience. What do you tend to recommend for making people feel comfortable?
See, first of all, stop scaring the kids at home. You know, if you have...
Oh my goodness, this is so true.
Yeah, scaring them. Because
if you don't brush your teeth, the dentist is going to get their drill out.
Yeah, exactly. You start this at home, and then finally when a problem comes up, then the dentist is the one who takes
up the... We're building you as the bad guy and girl.
Yeah. Exactly. So when the kids come in, you don't... you get them for regular visits. This is, I would really recommend. Okay, and... in my clinic, that's the reason I do free checkups for all. I don't charge for my consultations for this main reason, so that I tell, you know what I advise my patients, when you're passing by the road and you're really free and you're finished your shopping, just walk into my clinic, show me, let me see if anything is wrong. You know, I will not charge you for this. So they feel, you know, then they feel like coming, and we talk, we can have a small chat, and, you know, it's like that. It's a family when we are together. You should not treat them like patients, but treat them like a guest coming to your house, you know, that's the difference.
And this really does link to our next guest, Dr. Muir, about preventative medicine. You know, we tend to go to the doctor when we're sick. We might go to the dentist when we're in pain.
Exactly.
And by preempting some of these issues, these conditions, we can be hopefully be avoiding
all of this. Yeah, because most
of
them feel that, for kids especially, it's not necessary to go to the doctor until the kid does not complain of pain. And this is very wrong. Mm-hmm. And believe me, the kids suffer a lot, you know, even the normal kids, when you really wait for the pain to come. So just get a regular checkup, maybe once in three months or 6 months also will do. If there's a dentist nearby, or you're all welcome to come to my clinic anytime. So we can do a free checkup, and we can see and anticipate what's going to happen next, or where the cavity is developing. Do they need a cleaning, or, you know, and if everything is fine, a goodbye. And
so a staycation in Ras Al Khaimah and a trip to the dentist on the way home. Yeah, thank you so much, Doctor. Really appreciate it. We've had a couple of messages going, what is the clinic called? It's Signature Dental Clinic, Dr. Reshma. If you'd like her details, I'd be very happy to send them. So just send me a quick message on 4001. Thank you, Doctor. Really do appreciate your time.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We've just been talking dentistry there with Dr. Reshma, who was saying that so many people wait until they're in pain before getting into the dentist chair. And this can unfortunately lead to all sorts of negative associations to do with pain and fear and, you know, across all parts of the body. So many of us wait until we are sick or suffering before going to the doctor, when in reality, in a dream world, our health should be taken care of on a daily basis. So one lady who is promoting that, Dr. Maria Alonso, is with us, co-founder and medical director at Maison Santé Clinic. They're there in Althania Street, and delighted to welcome her to the studio. Dr. Maria, thank you so, so much for being with us today. How are you? You're glowing. I would expect nothing less.
Well, thank you. I'm feeling very well and honoured to be on the show because I'm a big fan, actually.
Oh, thank you so, so much. Well, we love talking health, and we do have a number of experts all the time who might come in with a specialism in a certain area of medicine or a body part, a condition or a symptom, whereas you look at preventative medicine as a whole, and you've got a team of people working with you at Maison Santé. But for anyone who's not familiar with the clinic, or perhaps you as a doctor, how do you describe your philosophy when it comes to health and healthcare?
Well, the philosophy actually is not getting sick.
That would be nice.
Not getting sick and going to the doctor before that happens. You know, this concept is outdated, that you go to the doctor only if something is paining, something doesn't feel right. So ideally, and that's also a concept in traditional Chinese medicine, mm-hmm. The part of the doctor is to keep people healthy. So if you follow that...
It's such a flip though, isn't it? It's such an adjustment to make, that someone is there to keep you healthy rather than to treat you when you're sick.
And that's really what I enjoy most. When I have people walking in saying, you know, I feel great, but I want to feel great in 20 years. So what can I do?
Yeah. Well, we're going to be talking about what we can do. And in terms of services and specialisms that you offer, this includes, as you mentioned, Chinese medicine, but also things like cupping, psychology, physiology.
Physiotherapy, manual lymphatic drainage, psychology. So yes, and we are like a full-fledged concept. So we have the clinic, we have a supplement shop, and we have a cafe with organic coffee, tea, and some healthy snacks.
Because it sounds like it is a bit of more of a lifestyle choice than a clinic. Does that make sense?
We call it a lifestyle concept.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what are some of the things that people are coming to you with, whether it is a concern or a complaint or, I guess, a health goal?
Well, actually, it's a big variety. You can consider it also a bit of family medicine. I have many patients where I see the mother, the father, the kids, the aunts, the grandparents. So it's like whole families, that I know the family history. I know what runs in their families and how they need to be supported, what to watch out for them. And so first of all, there is no age limitation on what we see there. And it depends what people need at that time. So it's a combination of things. So mm-hmm. They might need some blood tests to find out what's wrong. They might need advice on their nutrition, further testing. All sorts of things.
When it comes to, I guess, those tests and assessments, I think a lot of people come in and go, okay, I've been having gut problems or headaches. We've had a message about headaches. How do you then start to narrow down some of the questions you can be asking, or indeed the tests that you can be administering, to make sure you're getting treatment advice for that patient?
Most importantly is the history, to take time and really find out in detail what's happening. And if you come with headache, I might not ask you only about your headaches. I will ask you about how you sleep, how you go to the washroom, if you have any skin problems. So it's like an assessment of all your body functions plus your lifestyle. Because maybe you might tell me, you know, I work night shifts. And then that makes everything completely different. So it's really finding out what is the situation, what are the symptoms, and where they could come from. And to find out that, then there we will do specific tests. So it's not like, oh, everybody with a headache gets this battery of tests. No, that, we call it personalized medicine. So we really look into, for this person, what is the problem? Where could it come from? And what test makes sense?
And even, you know, everyone with a headache gets this specific prescription, because it could be to do with root cause that could be coming from any part of body or lifestyle or diet, or, as you say, family history.
Yeah, we were talking about migraines. You know, sometimes I have patients coming in saying, oh, you know, I have a migraine. And then after doing the history, finding most of the time it's actually a tension type headache.
Mm-hmm.
It's about posture, how they sleep, how they sit for hours on their laptop, their mobile.
Don't look at me like that.
No. Zero exercise, yeah. No stretching.
Well, I'm curious, Dr. Maria, what are some of the things that, if you could wave a magic wand and have everyone in Dubai do or change or eat or supplement with in order to keep our health as long as possible, what would you love to see everybody doing or trying?
Well, sleep enough, number one.
Define enough. What would you...
Well, there's a research about that, and it's 8 to 9 hours, believe it or not.
Sounds yes. amazing.
But I see people sleeping 4 to 5 hours and saying, no, that's fine for me. So let's say we can compromise maybe on 7. So
we can say sleep enough for you and your needs.
Yes. And second, eat real food. Real food, not just anything in a package with 20 ingredients, even if maybe 3 would be enough for mm-hmm. that specific food. So this is like the top 2. And then make sure or take care of your mental health.
Well, I'm glad you raised that. We were talking earlier about the study that's come out regarding SSRIs.
Yes, I read that.
And I would love to hear, because yes, in an ideal world, we're preventing all sorts of different things, but mental health can completely blindside you. But in a way of staying, I guess, optimally mentally healthy, what would you advise?
You know, I don't like to separate mental health from overall health. So how can you feel well if you have severe gut problems? You know, you constantly have pain, you cannot go to the bathroom, you don't sleep well, and you have tension type headache. Mm-hmm. How can you feel well? How can you have best energy and, you know, be glowing? Mm-hmm. You can't. So you have to look into everything. And let's talk serotonin. 80% of your serotonin is produced in your gut. So if you don't take care of your gut, of course, it might lead to, let's say, just mood disorders, just not feeling well. So if you ignore that and you just look at the side of classic mental health, you will miss out on a lot. Mm-hmm. So at Maison Santé, that's really what we try to do. We look at you holistically. And again, let me come back to Chinese medicine. In Chinese medicine, there's no differentiation between body and mind. So even someone with headache usually tends to have some mood disorders. So you are more easily irritable, which makes sense, mm-hmm. you know, little things like that. So when you treat someone, you ask that and you include that in the overall treatment.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking health today, preventative health, preventative medicine in particular. Joining us live in the studio is the co-founder and medical director of Maison Santé, Dr. Maria Alonso here. Let's see if we can bust a few myths. We've had some questions in on the text line asking, how much water do we really need to drink? Great question, Basma. Tell us, what's your take on this, Maria?
Oh, it's really a great question because you can't answer that for all. It depends. What is your height? What is your weight? Do you exercise? Do you sweat? Is it summer? Is it winter?
Are you in Dubai?
Are you in Dubai? Do you take meds? It depends. But you can say that most people will need at least 1 to 1.5 liters. And the best way to measure, it's very simple. You look at your pee. Your pee should be slight yellow, not transparent completely, not dark yellow, and not brown for sure. So that's the way.
It's the color test.
It's the color test. You can do it yourself and that will clear it out.
And what about this question here? No name on this message. And as we always say, no matter what you're getting in touch about, if you'd rather be anonymous to get the answers that you need, then that's absolutely fine with us. What does Dr. Maria think about probiotics and supplements we should all be taking? Can you explain the role of probiotics in the body? Because we've seen a lot of kind of information, misinformation, very expensive probiotics, people kind of totally poo-pooing them. What's your take?
Well, probiotics can be very, very beneficial for most people, depending on what you eat, if you took antibiotics or not. Part of your gut flora, your microbiome is destroyed and you need to replace that bacteria. I would always recommend to ask your doctor or physician about it. There's tests that you can do if you are not sure if you want to take it or not. There's stool test, and then you can find out exactly even which one you're missing. But generally, if you want to improve your digestion and your immune system, nothing wrong with taking a good quality probiotic. And please don't be blindsided by millions and billions and all that. At the end, what matters is where it stays and if there's a prebiotic in it. And, you know, if not, you will pull it out the same way. Mm-hmm. Plus, what additives are in there? Because sometimes you read like a ton of magnesium stearate and this and that. If it's something that you will be taking for a while, there should be no additives, so the quality matters. And of course, this additives will also hinder the absorption or the stability of it.
Now, I've been on air for nearly 2 hours and I haven't mentioned COVID-19. So let's address that. It's been a while since we've talked about the pandemic. But I'm curious, and I've just come back from Portugal where I saw a really good school friend of mine who lives in London. She was an early adopter and got COVID back in kind of May 2020, has had it twice. And she's just back from Cyprus at a long COVID clinic where she had blood taken. It was spun to remove microclots. It was re-injected again with a view to, well, who knows? I'm seeing so many different reports and clinics opening, so-called experts talking about how to cure long COVID. And you just mentioned the immune system there. And I was wondering if there's anyone who is out there who's suffering with immune issues, long COVID issues. Is this something that's coming into clinic?
Absolutely. And more and more. I see quite a number of patients with all different types of symptoms. So it can be anything from chronic fatigue since they had a sometimes lingering cough, body pains, irregular periods, mood disorder. So there's a big, big variety on symptoms. And of course, then treatment will depend on that. But mm-hmm. that's something that I see. And if not taken seriously and addressed, it can really stay for a very, very long time and affect your whole life.
She's had years now of respiratory problems. Yeah. And I think, actually a friend of a friend's currently in hospital with COVID. And I think we've kind of forgotten actually a little bit about just how severe some of the symptoms can be for certain
luckily
people.
Luckily for most people, they are very minor, but there are few that still suffer.
But it doesn't do any harm to boost your immune system as a preventant anyway.
Absolutely
what
not.
What do you tend to recommend?
Well, basic. Most people don't know their vitamin D levels, Insurance doesn't cover it, so it's mostly not done. And believe it or not, in this country, I see people that have a level of 5, 8, 9, when the minimum should be 40 and an optimum range is 50 to 70.
Wow.
Yeah.
So get that box ticked.
Yeah, get that box ticked. And then, of course, look into your diet, how much you sleep. Do you have gut issues? So likely that your microbiome might not be okay and you might need the probiotics. And so much more.
Can I ask you, Dr. Marie, on a daily basis, what are some of the things that you do? And it might be really seemingly simple to you, like a total given that might kind of blow our minds as people who aren't doctors, that you think perhaps we could all benefit from. It could be meditation, it could be supplements. What do you tend to think?
Yeah, first of all, you will think it's boring. I try to get up and go to sleep at the same time and get enough sleep, number
one. Sounds amazing.
And I try to eat real food. I'm gluten-free and dairy-free. And then I take supplements, depending on how I feel, if I will be traveling or not, if I'm more stressed or not. But there's a fair share of things that I take on a daily basis. Definitely magnesium at night is one of them. I take a B12 with folic acid. I take vitamin D if I'm not enough in the sun or on holidays. I take CoQ10. So, depending on what's going on, I make my cocktail.
You're giving me a shopping list. Dr. Maria, thank you so much. Pardon, Nebramash is going, what is the clinic name? Where is it? I'll let you give some directions.
The clinic name is Maison Santé. We are located in Meyan Mall, which is Altania Road, second floor. And
if you can find us
on social media as well.
Absolutely. If you would like those details, I'll be very happy to send them over. Just drop me a little message on 4001. I'll send you the website. You can find out more about Dr. Maria and her team there. And we'd love to have you back. I know you've got a great team there. So please, please, please keep us in mind, because judging by the number of questions, I think it's opened up a whole lot of thinking out there. Dr. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Helen.
Take care.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's the Psychology Hour. Now, sibling rivalry isn't always outgrown in childhood. Sometimes it just intensifies as time passes. So many of us often think of sibling rivalry as a childhood phenomenon. But adult sibling rivalry is more common than we might think. It could be adult siblings who are struggling to get along, argue, jealousy issues, could even be estranged from each other. Dr. Thryer with us this afternoon, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And first, let's hear some of my favourite siblings.
Oh, yeah, about telling Mom and Dad. I was thinking about maybe writing a letter.
But you know what? That's it. You've had your chance.
What?
Mom, Dad, Ross hasn't worked at the museum for a year!
Monica and Chandler are living together!
Rachel in Vegas and got divorced again!
any excuse to play a Friends clip. Monica and Ross there, being siblings as they do so well and not well at times. We are talking sibling rivalry today, and if this is something that's been an issue in your family or something you're looking to avoid in your own children, please do get in touch. Dr. Thryer with us, clinical psychologist, to take your questions and mine anonymously if you prefer. Thryer, how are you?
I'm well, Helen. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad we're not on camera today because I fell asleep at 2 a.m. last night, wide awake. So I've got the glassy eyes today. But it's interesting timing on the old sibling rivalry chat because a lot of people are on family holidays and I think things can get a little bit explosive. So it's an interesting one because, as I said, we do think that sibling rivalry is something that, you know, there might be a, you know, punch on the arm, or he stole this from me and she wore this from my wardrobe, or as they get older, you know, she's looking at my boyfriend, or, you know, whatever that might be. But when you get to your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, some of these issues don't go away. They simply change. Can you explain from, I guess, a psychology point of view, how you view adult sibling rivalry?
Well, you know, it's actually very similar to children sibling rivalry. And in the end, it's this competition that happens between siblings for either attention or recognition from parents. And then that develops into a strained relationship between the siblings. And that just continues where one person's trying to prove themselves over another sibling. And so, you know, even though the rivalry actually begins in childhood, it continues and can actually progress into adulthood as well. And they, you know, in adulthood, people will struggle to get along, they'll argue, and sometimes they might even be estranged from one another. So it's not really just a childhood thing. And it's very important that parents keep that in mind and watch out for it, because what you want to do is try to mitigate that at a very young age so it doesn't continue as it moves forward.
Does it come up much in sessions here with clients?
Well, of course, because essentially what we'll see is that, you know, people will discuss how their parents treated them differently from their siblings, or even, you know, and birth order plays a very big role here. So at times, the first child tends to be the parentified child for many cultures. And this is the type of child that is kind of almost like a surrogate parent. And so they end up taking care of the other siblings. They end up holding so much more responsibility. The expectations on them are very, very high, as well as sometimes there's a lot of animosity towards their younger siblings because they have to take care of everything and they have to do everything. And they kind of neglect themselves because that's the role that their parents give them. So birth order plays a very big role in sibling rivalry. And the stronger that happens at home from the parents, the more likely the children are to engage in that as they continue as well. And the parentified child, or let's say, for instance, the first birth order child, they might end up taking on a role as the third parent. Mm-hmm. And that can be very detrimental to creating proper relationships of siblings rather than another parent to the other children.
And that kind of favoritism piece, it can, as you say, kind of often worsen as you grow up. And that might be, you know, getting married first, having children first, a profession that they might approve of over another one. And your research has shown that, you know, parenting obviously plays a significant role in adult sibling rivalry. And, you know, parents can have the best will in the world to remain unbiased throughout, you know, from birth to adulthood. But favoritism is actually probably more common than we care to admit.
Absolutely. You know, there's so many studies that have shown that, you know, 70% of mothers could easily specify the child that they get along with the most. And although they say, oh, but I love all of my kids equally, yes, but you like one a little bit more because they tend to have either similar personalities or a personality that you can get along with. And actually, only about 15% of children really felt, in many of these studies, felt that there's equal treatment between all of the siblings. So you can see that there's a significant number of individuals that feel like there was different treatment amongst family members. And when you have one parent that has one kind of favorite child, and then the other parent has another favorite child, and then you have more than two children. This is where now we're talking about, you know, a child that's feeling left out, or maybe even becoming more competitive because they want more recognition, more attention from their parents. So although we would like to think that we don't love kids differently, the reality is that we may not love them differently, but we do treat them differently depending on how they react and respond to us and how we react and respond to them.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live on the line is Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, and we're unpicking sibling rivalry in adults. Yes, we do tend to think of it as being, you know, the whack in the back of the car seat, or the, you know, she took this. In adults, it can look very, very different indeed. And judging by the messages, to be honest, this is perhaps far more common than we'd realised. Dr. Thryer, I want to really kind of come back to a message that we got earlier, which is really trying to draw the distinction between sibling rivalry in adulthood and effectively bullying. So no name on this message, and as ever, you can be anonymous if you prefer. We totally understand. We want to make sure you have a platform and, of course, the opportunity to get the answers that you might need. I'm guessing a female listener saying, my sister is 15 years older than me and our relationship isn't close. I'm the youngest with siblings in between us. As a young child, physical attacks would be the norm. It was seen by mum various times and blamed on annoying toddler / grumpy teen dynamic. As adults at family events, I'm either ignored by her or get really passive-aggressive comments with smiles. I've often thought I'm being too sensitive and dismissed at a sibling rivalry or age gap, but my husband has suggested it verges on bullying due to the anxious nature it causes and not wanting to see her. I feel like I want to step away from the situation, but also feel torn that I could be misinterpreting things and lose that sibling relationship. Dr. Thryer, I guess this comes to, well, first of all, trying to understand how you feel about that relationship, drawing some boundaries. And this message here, I feel torn, because it's not like a friendship where you can say, okay, I'm going to choose not to see you anymore, and there might be implications on a friendship group. But with a family, it is so much more complicated. What would you say?
It definitely is complicated, because in essence, what you're, like you said, Helen, you can't just get rid of your family members. In many cases, it's very difficult to do so. So one of the things that I recommend to be able to tell the difference between sibling rivalry and really bullying is having that conversation with your sibling, especially as an adult. It's very easy to have an open and limpid conversation with them. So when you're having that conversation, you kind of say, you know, I really don't appreciate it when you speak to me in this manner, or, and, you know, setting those boundaries, as you had said, Helen, if you can do that, and then the person feels apologetic or tries their best to change, these are the things that you can notice are more sibling rivalry. But when the person dismisses you, kind of invalidates how you're feeling, minimizes it, and then continues, regardless of how it's making you feel, I would definitely classify this a little more as bullying than it is sibling rivalry.
You mentioned earlier, Thryer, about favouritism, and T has been in touch saying, my dad has always had a favourite, my younger brother, because he was sporty like him and I wasn't, and that has always made me feel not good enough. As a result, I'd argue a lot with my brother, and to this day, 15 years on, I still feel slightly angry towards him, basically because I didn't get the same treatment and attention from my dad as he did, but my brother never really noticed it. And a question here from Parveen saying, my sister and I have always been close. We're now in our 40s, but she talks to me the same way she always has. She can be quite envious due to her own insecurities she's had since childhood and attacks me to this day with the odd sarcastic comment. I find it disrespectful. How can I create healthy sibling barriers and boundaries as we get older? It's a very similar kind of assessment, I guess, to what we had earlier. This self-awareness, I think, is really important to kind of think, hang on, why am I being treated like this? I'm in my 40s now. Why am I so, so intimidated by somebody?
And it's really interesting, you know, because, Helen, we have three ways of speaking in general, right? And we call this transactional analysis of communication, which is essentially we speak as either the parent, the adult, or the child. And in essence, when someone speaks to us as a parent, our automatic nature is to kind of move back into child mode. So when a sibling speaks to us like a parent would, in a condescending kind of, you know, authoritative manner, our tendency is, even in adulthood, to go back into that childhood communication style. So it's important for us to try to maintain that adult communication and remember that you are no longer that child. Mm-hmm. Now you're at a position where age doesn't matter in any way, shape, or form. And it's okay to have that conversation and say, you know, I'm really not comfortable with the way that you're speaking to me. And I would appreciate that you either change your tone or maybe we can come to an agreement on how to discuss things with each other without you kind of, you know, using me as a punching bag in the, mm-hmm. in the process of having this conversation. So even though it is it's a natural reaction to kind of move back into childhood mode and feel like that child again, you want to do your best to remind yourself that you are not that child anymore and try to maintain an open communication as an adult.
I'm laughing because whenever the four of us as a family are under one roof, we all revert to, I can tell you, I'm 16, I'm asking for a lift. My brother's 13, huffing and puffing and grunting about not wanting to empty the dishwasher. You know, it's just absolutely classic. And it does take an awful lot of awareness and willpower to go, hang on, I'm 40, I've got two children of my own. How do we fall back into these patterns?
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's the Psychology Hour, and we often talk about navigating different forms of relationships as we get older. You know, marriages, friendships, the bond we share with our parents, but we rarely talk about navigating adult sibling relationships. You know, those people you grew up with who have most likely seen the absolute worst and maybe a bit of the best of you as well. Dr. Thryer's here this afternoon as we talk about adult sibling rivalry. She's a clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And a number of messages, Dr. Thryer, on this topic. It is such an emotive one because it takes us back to childhood. You know, an interaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am, I'd say, quite close with my brother. We probably chat every couple of weeks. But he knows me better than almost anyone. He knows how to make me absolutely crack up laughing in a couple of words, but he knows how to absolutely destroy me in a couple of words. He knows all my weak spots. And when I think about it, takes me back. It takes me back to having that jealousy of him as a child. It takes me back to the physical fights we had. And I say this without any hesitation. I loved him desperately, but I also, you know, wished many a time that he'd never been born. Like, truthfully, he's got scars on his right. hands from me. You know, we smashed doors. We were wild. And there's something so kind of visceral and physical about that sibling relationship that just seems to evolve as we get older. And we've had messages where, you know, that kind of intensity hasn't gone away. It has just shifted, I suppose. Jay says, I used to respect and look up to my older brother. After the years of being ignored, placed second best in everything, I gave up and stopped talking to him. He used to make fun of my weight, call me a fat whale. I don't miss the relationship. And when I'm not around him, I don't have to compare myself to him. Unfortunately, though, it does mean that we've never had a relationship. I've got to live with that. And I'm jealous of people that do have that with their siblings. So what about, I guess, if you haven't got a happy, healthy relationship with your adult siblings, do you think it can ever be too late to rebuild or build that?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think it depends on the type of rivalry that the individuals had together. I mean, you know, like we mentioned already, Helen, like that favoritism, birth order, age gap, even gender, by the way, because for a lot of cultures, a specific gender is usually ignored more than another. Sometimes as people get older, if they don't have education as high or as expected as other individuals, or if they're married, they're usually neglected as those siblings that are married and have children. So there's so much pain that comes from all of this. And this can affect a person quite a bit because you feel rejected by not just your parents, but also by the sibling themselves. You know, you worry about who you are and what that means about you. It's really difficult to resolve conflicts. And sometimes you carry that heaviness with you and looking at other people that may have better relationships with their own siblings, it might really hurt you mm-hmm. to recognize that you don't necessarily have that. Now, that being said, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't develop a relationship with your sibling, and maybe not so much of a sibling relationship, maybe more as a diplomatic, kind, mm-hmm. caring friendship, or at least you start somewhere. Because normally what we do is we put pressure on ourselves to create this brotherhood or sisterhood or siblingship between family members, because we think that that's what we need to do. But in essence, if there's a lot of rivalry, is if there's a lot of pain, sometimes a good place to start is just, you know, at the bottom and start with just being diplomatic and being respectful, and then working towards creating maybe a superficial friendship, and then working towards a closer friendship. And then maybe you can develop into, you know, having that brotherly, sisterly kind of relationship. And maybe not, but at least it'll be a relationship that's much better than what it is right now.
What about any parents who are listening this afternoon who want to foster a good sibling relationship in their children? And I know at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, you work with children, you work with teens. And I'm just curious if there's anything, I don't want to say do's and don'ts, but any recommendations you have from a psychologist's point of view that can really help foster a healthy, hopefully happy relationship that could last through the years.
You know, I think there's a quite an interesting concern that most parents come to us with, is this idea of, like, if I get too involved when they're fighting, am I sheltering them? And if I don't get involved, am I contributing to sibling rivalry? And that's a very good question, because where do you draw the line? I think it's important to take a step back first and say to yourself, what are you doing that is contributing to the sibling rivalry that exists regardless? Mm. And that usually has to do with the things that we talked about, you know, like gender, or how you treat them, the favoritism, if one is more connected to you, how much time you spend with them, how you reprimand one over the other.
Oh,
sometimes
yes.
We're a little bit more lenient on one than we are on the other, because sometimes, you know, we think, oh, this person's a little bit more emotional or sensitive, and therefore we need to be easier on them. And all of this plays a very big part in sibling rivalry. So I think from a parental perspective, the first thing that you need to do is take a step back and say, what am I doing that's contributing to this? And then take a look at, how do you handle conflict at home? So this is very important, because you and your partner are modeling the type of behavior that your children are basically going to adopt moving forward in terms of conflict. So if there is no conflict resolution when something happens, this is very problematic. Things need to be communicated. They need to be talked out. People need to share how they felt about certain things. They need to resolve. This is extremely important. So if conflict is kind of like thrown under the rug, or just like one person is punished, or both people are punished and go to your rooms and things like that, this is not proper conflict resolution. So I think it, for parents, it's extremely important to take a look at, what are you doing? And at the same time, how are you resolving conflict at home? And what are you modeling, and what are you encouraging within your children?
That's so interesting to think about. Because as you say, we've modeled what our, you know, how our parents raised us. And what I find interesting in our family, and when I say family, I mean me, my husband, and my children, is I'm the oldest, whereas my husband is the youngest. So with my older daughter, I see how he says to her, you know, go and put your shoes away and get your sister's as well. And I'm like, hang on, why is she taking her sister's, you know, shoes? Because that was me. I was the one that was dumped on as the older child, having to take on the more responsibility and more of the caring role. And I guess I identify more with her because we've got a similar experience. We've got that annoying, quote unquote, you know, younger sibling who seems to be getting, you know, a bit of softer treatment. And then I guess conversely, he feels, you know, more sympathetic, more of a, you know, an empathetic relationship with the younger one, who's, yeah, that's so, that is really, really interesting. But how often do you actually take the time to kind of clue into that? Because as families, we're really just trying to survive day to day.
Right. And you're really busy. You have so many things to worry about. So it's understandable that, you know, you're not always going to catch every single time something like this happens. But as much as you can, it's really beneficial. And the more that you do, the more likely children will learn from your modeling. And this is so important. And I think one of the most important things, at least for adults, when they are exposed to the sibling rivalry, is to recognize that the parental relationship between parent and your sibling as you get older, you should separate that relationship from the relationship that you want to have with your sibling. So what your parents did to your brother or your sister and how they treated them is not your brother or sister's fault. Yes, they probably fed into it. Yes, they probably used it to their advantage, as any human would.
Path of least resistance. Yeah, of course.
Right. So, but in reality, it's not their fault that your parents treated them the way that they did. And separating that is so important because it gives you that sense of empathy towards your siblings and recognizing that if my parents hadn't treated us in the way that they did, then probably our relationship would have been stronger. So minimizing that kind of competition between each other is very important. Also, like, taking accountability for what you did. And this is a really hard pill to swallow is when we're kind of like, okay, what did I do to contribute to this behavior as well? Because we were children, true, but at this point we're now adults. So what am I doing that is contributing to this kind of relationship that I have with my siblings? Mm-hmm. You know, reflecting on that relationship piece, separating yourself from parent-child relationship versus child and sibling relationship, that's really important. And I would have to say, above all, communication is key. Setting proper boundaries. If your siblings are mistreating you, it's important for you to communicate that because now you are an adult and you are no longer that child that either needs to be quiet or don't say anything or so on and so forth. But right now you are the adult and you can develop a relationship where you can enjoy with your siblings. There just needs to be some form of reforming mm-hmm. of the type of the relationship that you have. And maybe a sibling relationship will never probably be there because of the amount of pain, depending on the situation. However, a relationship can exist between you and them.
And presumably as adults, we can have these conversations with our parents as well and say, you know, I perhaps didn't realize this as a child, but now that I'm older and I've got experience and more confident, the way you treat XYZ is not fair. It's not equal to, you know, and this is how it's affected me. And I'm going to remember this next time I'm home as a family of four and I'm asking for a lift and my brother doesn't want to empty the dishwasher and we call him the golden child. But it's been really interesting, Thoraya, to kind of unpick this. And thank you to everyone who's been in touch. We've had stories about sibling rivalry for decades and it going on under the roof right now. So a really emotive one and something that perhaps we don't realize the impact on our lives. Just those it takes two to tangle as children, and it definitely can take a different form as we move into adulthood. Dr. Thoraya, thank you so much for your time.
We'll catch up
with you next week. And if anyone does want Dr. Thoraya's details or indeed that of the clinic, as I said earlier, they treat children, adolescents, marriage therapy, and of course, individual treatments as well. Be very happy to send those through if you want to send me a message on 4001. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.